loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we'll dive into the latest developments in U.S.-Russia relations, including President Putin's invite to come to the White House, the political fallout from the invitation, and how it's all tied in with a Mueller investigation. And then, it's our regular Friday segment with the Lookmans. We take a look at political races across the country in the run-up to midterm elections in November. Today, we'll cover Ocasio-Cortez, De Leon over Feinstein, and the House Democrats' ridiculous new slogan.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Israeli occupation authorities are facing more protests today in Gaza as at least two Palestinians were killed and three were injured in an Israeli air raid and at the Gaza border. Israel has pledged an even tougher response to Palestinians, sending flammable kites and balloons carrying firebombs across the border. Next, a secret letter was just revealed yesterday from former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak to then-CIA Acting Director Gina Haspel, asking for support in a competitive election last May. He painted current Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad as a threat to U.S. interests. Najib has since been indicted on several corruption charges, including abuse of power. Then, a South Korean court today sentenced former President Park Geun-hye to an additional 8 years in prison for abusing state funds and violating election laws. Park is already serving 24 years in prison for a massive corruption scandal. And then Kathy Craninger, President Trump's nominee to lead the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, went in front of the Senate Banking Committee yesterday, where she fully dodged many senators' questions. What we did find out is that she has almost no financial experience, having worked most of her career in the Department of Homeland Security. So why is she the nominee for the CFPB? And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. And in other headlines, a microburst storm hit a Missouri lake yesterday where a tourist duck boat was floating and 17 of the 31 passengers have been killed. When the boat was recovered today, it was 80 feet underwater in Table Rock Lake outside Branson, Missouri. Charlie Rowley, one of the two people in Salisbury, England, who were hospitalized after being poisoned by a substance that was alleged to be Novichok, has been released from the hospital there. His partner, Don Sturgis, died after the alleged poisoning. And the other two people allegedly affected by poison in the same area, Sergei and Yulia Skripal, were released months ago from the hospital. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is vowing to stay in office while also working on Germany's relationship with the United States, which she characterized as, quote, under strong pressure, unquote. She noted that the relationship is crucial and that she will carry on cultivating it. The governments of Turkey and the Netherlands released a joint statement today expressing their intention to restore full diplomatic relations. Tensions between the two countries flared last year when Dutch authorities interfered with Turkish government officials' efforts to campaign among the country's diaspora in the Netherlands in the run-up to the controversial 2017 constitutional reform referendum. Turkey and the Netherlands are now expected to exchange ambassadors, which were withdrawn as a consequence of last year's crisis. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and clear.
Now we turn to the latest developments in U.S.-Russia relations and the Mueller investigation. Once again, chaos is engulfing Washington over a series of U-turns made by the Trump administration in the wake of the Trump-Putin Helsinki summit. Meanwhile, developments in the Mueller probe are making it clearer than ever that the investigation is deeply connected to the big picture of U.S.-Russia relations. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. And we're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
So, Ted, let's start with you. I mean, it's almost hard to know where to begin, but let's talk about the Mueller investigation first. It's been an extremely eventful week. What are some of your big takeaways?
Well, it looks like Michael Cohen is preparing to flip. Looks like there's movement afoot that we might actually see a report soon. It's like we see more of the generic party splits where we had the crazy hearing the other day where we had Republican congressmen going absolutely bananas, not the word I would use, but I assume this is a family station, so I can't say bat blah blah. And anyway, all hell's breaking loose. Everyone wants to know what Mueller's got. This is deemed as having gone on too long, I think, by all concerned, and Republicans in particular. And obviously, this is all highlighted by, as you pointed out in your opener, about what happened in Helsinki between Presidents Putin and Trump, where Trump, as I said in my cartoon for Sputnik, said, he managed to piss off MSNBC and the rest of the corporate media by being something that Trump generally is not, which is open-minded, polite, and diplomatic. And that seems to be something that the media does not want to see from Donald Trump, even though they've been criticizing him for being all the opposite of those things in most other respects. So it seems like something's happening, but as the old song says, what it is ain't exactly clear.
Mark, go ahead. And especially I'm interested in these indictments that came, it seems to me, like strategically timed before and after the Helsinki summit. So before you had these 12 Russians indicted, and then immediately following it, you have the indictment of Maria Butina. Go ahead. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is rather interesting because the timing, of course, was obviously, but the question is by who? Bloomberg has a piece out this week, and what I take is a leak from the White House, that it was actually Trump who asked for the indictments to be released before the summit because he thought it would give him leverage with Putin. Now, I have no way of knowing if that is true or not. It would certainly attribute a higher level of diplomatic skill, of diplomatic manipulation to Trump than I would have given him on my own regard. But that story is out there. Whether it was him or whether it was people trying to prevent the summit from taking place, certainly the Democrats called for it to be canceled. There's no question that the indictments came with very specific and political, you could even say geopolitical, timing. I have to disagree with a little bit of characterization. The Russian papers are not quite saying the same thing that the Western papers are saying about the summit. One of the things that the Western papers are saying is that it was a big victory for Vladimir Putin, for the president of Russia, that Russia won, and it showed the U.S. president as humiliated and a Manchurian candidate and more rumors and suggestions about PP tapes or other pieces of blackmail or whatnot. That is not at all the way that the Russian papers and the Russian public is treating it, aside from the diplomatic language of the Kremlin. The Russian political elite and, the journalists, what they're discussing is that the summit was most likely a disaster, that Trump's performance was unhinged. He started going off into insecure defenses of his election, ranting about the Electoral College. Some of this I think you can probably understand, in that I do believe that there is a partisan political witch hunt at home that's targeting him, but it still doesn't do him any credit when he's sitting beside one of the other major world leaders. I think he was also too obsequious. I think he should have had, however, his feelings of wanting to improve relations, he should have been a little bit at a remove. And the worry that many are discussing here is they're much more sober about the results from the summit. They think that Trump is in too vulnerable a domestic political position at home, and they worry that the end result of the summit might have actually been to worsen relations between the U.S. and Russia. And they don't have a lot of confidence in Trump that he will either be able to remain in office or be able to carry out his promises against the deep state and a political culture from Congress, media on down, that is absolutely opposed to any type of detente with Russia.
That's what's going to make this so complicated and so difficult, is here you've got a president who thinks that he's acting boldly. Whether you agree with him or not, he thinks he's acting boldly. But there's no one in Washington that supports these purportedly or apparently bold moves. You have the director of national intelligence, who it was reported in the Washington papers today, laughed at him when he heard that that Bolton had invited Putin to Washington. You've got members of his own party in the House and the Senate condemning the outcome of the Helsinki summit and condemning further the invitation to Putin. You have Democrats jumping up and down and yelling that they see electoral victory out of this ham-handed attempt to conduct foreign policy. And then you have a president who's standing alone, who thinks that he's smarter than everybody else, and he's just going to double down and push through and wait until people begin to follow him.
So no one's accusing Donald Trump of being the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he still seems to know what his base is doing, even if he's not getting the approval of either Democratic or Republican elites in Washington or the media. Even he's even being criticized on Fox News these days, which is normally his house organ. So according to the latest tracking poll, 79% of Republicans highly approve of his performance in Helsinki with President Putin, and 91% of Democrats highly disapprove. It's an incredible split. But Trump's strategy from day one, and it's what's gotten him the Republican nomination and elected president, has been to cater to his base, and he has not deviated from that one bit. And this seems to be just part and parcel of the same. I don't think the invitation to Putin to come to the White House is going to affect that base. I think he literally can just shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, and it would be just fine for them.
Ted, can I jump in there and ask you a question? I saw those same numbers. I highlighted them myself. I think it was 62% of independents also disapproved. Ted, do you think that Trump's base wants improved relations with Russia, and he's catering to them, or that it's just partisan support no matter what Trump does?
Well, obviously, it's hard to know scientifically without asking additional questions, which I'm obviously not able to do to the people who answered the poll. But my guess is that it's mostly partisanship, knee jerk. Look, whatever Trump does is fine with us. Now, that said, there is a substantial part of the GOP that does still come from the paleoconservative Pat Buchanan, America First, let's not start unnecessary wars faction. And I think some of them belong to that.
Yeah. Yep.
Mark, let me get your thoughts on the response of the Trump administration, or how the Trump administration handled the chaos in Washington following the Helsinki meeting, because they've taken so many different positions, and Trump personally has taken on so many different positions and recollections and spins since at first he sort of backtracked a little bit. He said, wouldn't, not would, but then he sort of doubled down on his support for improving relations. And then at the end of it all, this is sort of the latest big development. Last night, news broke that Vladimir Putin was invited to the White House to have a follow-up meeting. What do you think about the handling post-summit of diplomatic relations that the Trump administration has displayed?
Yeah, it's just embarrassing. And I think it shows, first of all, the wide gulf between Trump and much of his own administration. I felt, watching some of those videos where Trump retracts his woods for wooden, it felt to me like watching a hostage video. You could practically see someone with a gun, albeit a political one, behind his head saying, "This is what you're supposed to read." So I thought it was embarrassing. I don't think anyone believed it, and I'm someone who would support improving relations with Russia. But I don't think anyone believes his retractions. And he's constantly waffled on the side of not believing, I think with good reason, U.S. intelligence on many of the details of this whole hacking and influence, this projectionist story of Russia meddling in U.S. elections rather than, say, the other way around. So I think it's been bungled badly. I think it shows the divisions in the White House, and I don't think anyone really believes what Trump is saying with that, probably, again, not even his own administration and people.
Ted, if you ask most of Congress, most of the people in the media, Mark just committed treason because he doubted the assessments of our brave intelligence officers. Talk about this phenomenon where, we have this extreme deification of anything the CIA or NSA says, and any deviation from that is like un-American.
Yeah, well, that's been a major talk point of the Democratic Party. I guess it started out as a traditional enemy of my enemy is my friend, since the FBI and was investigating Trump. Downright embarrassing. I mean, this is the same FBI that was shot the Black Panthers in their sleep in the 60s in COINTELPRO. It's the same CIA that murdered Allende. It's the same, it's the same NSA that Edward Snowden revealed was spying on every American's email and personal phone calls. So, I mean, these are the intelligence community, which is a ridiculous phrase to begin with, is not a credible source of information. Even if they happen to be telling the truth, if they say the sky is blue, I want to check it out. And I think anyone sane would feel that way. And it's really particularly strange to see Democrats who traditionally have been skeptical of these organizations, particularly, for example, after Watergate with the Church Commission and so on, to roll back the powers of the CIA, to see them saying, well, I think the CIA and the FBI have become what the firefighters and the cops were after 9/11. They're sainted heroes. You can say they can do no wrong. And it's just damn well bizarre. I think anyone with half a thought in their mind can see how bizarre it is. And then meanwhile, you have Republicans who are traditionally have always been the guardians of these kind of state police forces, expressing skepticism about their results. I mean, that's very welcome. I would have liked to have seen the same skepticism during the build-up to the Iraq War. But now it's, we live in wacky turnover alternative world. It's Spock has a beard. Nothing is right.
Yeah, I'm a U.S. military veteran. I served 6 years in the military, and I remember the Iraq War very well. And I think it was a watershed coming-of-age moment, not just for me, but for a lot of other people. The U.S. intelligence community and the government lied to the American people to take them to war. It wasn't the first time, but it was, perhaps the most blatant and obvious even at the time. They didn't make a mistake. I want to be clear about that. They lied to take the United States to war. Then we saw the same things again in Libya and Syria. I get a lot of hate for saying this, but in that Iraq war, when the U.S. was insisting Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, Vladimir Putin said that he didn't, and he was right. So I'm not saying that necessarily make sure you should believe everything that Vladimir Putin says. I don't, or disbelieve everything the U.S. intelligence community says. Again, I don't. But I think you have to take everything with a grain of salt and examine the evidence. And they really haven't provided any evidence, and that's part of the whole problem I have with this whole narrative. And we need to be clear that this isn't really even the intelligence community. It's certainly not 17 intelligence agencies. It's actually a hand cherry-picked group of operatives from three agencies and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which isn't properly an agency, that were operating outside of usual working parameters where you have other groups within checking, verifying, and vetting each other department's work from different angles within the departments when they came up with this assessment. And that is what is being presented to the American people as the God's honest truth. And that doubting it again is it makes me a traitor to my country and a lot of other people. And this group was put together by John Brennan, Obama's CIA director. John Brennan perjured himself twice to Congress and the American people and suffered no repercussions for it. Right? He left office, with medals and honors, and now he's feeding us our propaganda directly as a pundit at CNN. Talk about your media intelligence complex. It's positively dystopian. It's something like they might have guessed the Soviet Union would do. It's really all quite more than shady. It's actually scary.
Ted, I want to go in a bit of a different direction. We've got, I believe, about 5 minutes left. There was some additional news that broke about the Mueller investigation. This isn't, obviously directly tied to the big picture of U.S.-Russia relations, but I think, it's all mixed together. Mueller offered immunity or granted immunity to five people in the as part of his efforts to prosecute Paul Manafort. And one of those people, according to Fox News, they cited two unnamed sources, so of course we can't say this with 100% certainty, but it's being reported that one of those people offered immunity is Tony Podesta. Now, Tony Podesta and Paul Manafort, they did the same thing. They lobbied on behalf of Ukrainian political interests, and they didn't register, right? Paul Manafort is facing many, many years in prison, but Tony Podesta, he's out. He is now apparently being granted immunity, possibly being granted immunity. Give us your thoughts on that or any other reflections on how the Manafort prosecution is proceeding.
Certainly, Republicans have been taking a very dark view of the very different treatment of Mr. Podesta and Manafort. Republicans are pointing out that Manafort, a Republican, is being prosecuted, as you say, whereas Podesta, a Democrat and crony of the Clintons, brother of John Podesta, is better connected, and that's why he's getting this better deal. Certainly, I'm sure at this point, Manafort feels like a motorist who was pulled over for going 75 and a 55, and he sees other cars zooming past and asking the cop, why aren't you pulling those guys over? They're going at least as fast as I am. Everyone knows that feeling. But, you know, no one knows, obviously, but Mueller, why he did that. There's any number of possible explanations. I suppose the most charitable one would simply be that Manafort is the bigger fish, and he's hoping to leverage Manafort's prosecution into something else, and he doesn't have as much on Podesta. Or it could be just that Manafort is himself the end result, and that's as far high that he's getting. Manafort is enough for Mueller. It seems usually when investigators and prosecutors offer immunity, they offer immunity to the person who did less, the smaller fish, in order to get the bigger fish. But it's hard to get into Mueller's head on this one and figure out exactly how he's assessing it, because the investigation hasn't had that many leaks so far, at least not in that respect, in terms of strategy.
Mark, go ahead. What do you think about this Manafort-Podesta situation?
Selective application of law is not law. It's tyranny, right? Let's be clear about that. And FARA is the most rarely and selectively applied law, perhaps on the entirety of the U.S. books, and almost every one application of it now via one other that was unsuccessful.
That's the Foreign Agent Registration Act.
Right, the Foreign Agent Registration Act. Now, as anyone in Washington, D.C. will tell you, and many U.S. media sources have admitted in the past days, Washington, D.C. is chock full of unregistered lobbyists. Americans representing other governments, Israelis, Saudis, the Chinese, everyone, right? If the law was actually applied, they would probably have to lay siege to K Street and build an entire new system of federal prisons to house all the unregistered lobbyists like this. Now, it is likely, well, first of all, the complete injustice of this whole thing with the Podesta brothers, and, you know, I'm not a big fan of Manafort myself, but the Podesta brothers and Manafort are both slimy, political Machiavellian creatures, you know, gray eminences behind the scenes in D.C. To apply it to one and not the other, I mean, it sounds like grounds for disqualifications. None of this has anything to do with the election or even Russia in any substantial way, and certainly not collusion between Russia and Trump during the election. This is a fishing expedition. This is the curious U.S. judicial practice of pursuing a completely unrelated legal offense and essentially blackmailing, in this case Manafort, with prosecution on this, unless he says what they want on something else. And this is supposed to be justice. This is the idea of trying to get Manafort to flip with it, get enough leverage on him. And then the flipping, of course, he's going to say what they want if he feels significantly threatened. That the idea that this is justice rather than selective application of a law and blackmail is rather curious to me, to say the least.
So, Ted Rall, Paul Manafort's trial is due to start July 25th. It could drag on for a long time. It could drag on into this Putin's summit, this Putin visit to the White House that's apparently going to be happening in the fall. It'll be interesting to see those two things sort of happening almost in parallel. But I honestly wonder if this Putin visit to the White House is even going to happen in the first place. I mean, Trump obviously doesn't like to back down in certain circumstances, on things like this, I think he would be, you know, loath to back down or seen as being weak and retreating. But the amount of pressure is pretty amazing. One minute left. You think it's actually going to happen?
Well, there's even more pressure here than there was on him when he was preparing for his summit with North Korean leader Kim. And so certainly, if he backs down, it wouldn't be totally shocking. But he did meet with Kim. And I think what is the more likely outcome is that the summit will occur. But as with Kim, Trump's attention span may be too short to be willing to hash out a Reagan-Gorbachev-style meeting of minds that would take many, many hours and days and weeks to make work. So I suspect what we're looking at is, if I had to put money on it, I wouldn't put a lot of money on it, but I'd probably put it on the side of summit happens, not much comes out of it.
Hey, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. And we were joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Again today, we take a look at political races around the country in the run-up to midterm elections in November. And today we'll cover Ocasio-Cortez, De Leon over Feinstein, and the House Democrats' new slogan, which is terrible. We're joined from Washington by Jacqueline Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Jackie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Jackie, you sent me a list of things that you want to talk about. I have a list of things that I want to talk about, but let's jump into specific races first and tell us what's interesting to you about Ocasio-Cortez and Crowley.
Well, I think it's really interesting that Crowley is still insisting on Twitter that he's not intending to run against Ocasio-Cortez.
We should remind our listeners, too, what we're talking about here is that very unusual Democratic primary in Queens and the Bronx, where the 29-year-old Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez beat a 10-term incumbent, Crowley. But Crowley is still on the general election ballot under the, I think it's the Workers' Party or the Family
Working Families,
Working
Party,
Families yeah. Party. Right. So go ahead.
Yeah. So the procedure for getting his name off the ballot is really interesting in this district in New York. In order to take his name off of every line item on the ballot after a candidate loses the main primary, he has to either die, commit a felony and be convicted, or run for another office on that ballot, or he has to, the candidate has to register to vote in another state. Now, you know, of course, like we said last week, we're not, you know, encouraging Crowley to pass away. We don't expect him to commit a crime that he has to be convicted of. He doesn't want to run for another office, which I completely understand. But the thing that he could do, which is not actually unreasonable, is to register to vote in another state. And that's not unusual because his family actually lives in Virginia. His children go to school in Virginia. And the Workers' Family Party has been trying to work with him to get his name taken off of the ballot. But he has rejected all of their overtures to take his name off the ballot. So even though Crowley says he's not running against Ocasio-Cortez, the reality is, as long as his name is on that ballot, people can vote against her for him.
Yes.
And it's really a mess. It makes Crowley look really petty. But now Joe Lieberman has weighed in.
Of all people.
Of all people. And came out with an op-ed in the New York Times basically saying that Ocasio-Cortez is not only like a threat to the Democratic Party, but a threat to America.
A threat to America because she beat him. That's why she's a threat to America, because she beat him. And she's exactly what the Democratic establishment is afraid of.
Exactly. And we're looking at someone who is espousing policies that are absolutely worker friendly. They're people friendly. They're progressive. They are the representation of what policies that would push us toward progress for greater equality in this society are supposed to be. And Joe Lieberman is saying that this woman who's espousing those policies are a threat to the party and the country. That's horrendous for the Democratic Party.
It really is. And it just smacks of sour grapes, which is interesting to me and disappointing at the same time. Now, several months ago, Jackie, you and I talked about this California Senate race between Dianne Feinstein and Kevin De Leon. Kevin De Leon was pretty well whipped in the primary, but California has that weird, very unusual system where, regardless of party, the top two vote getters are the two people who go onto the ballot in November in the general election. Well, Feinstein got something like 46%. De Leon got 12%, but there were so many Republicans running that nobody got more than 11. So on the ballot in November is going to be Dianne Feinstein and Kevin De Leon. Well, this week, the California Democratic Party, this is the executives that actually run the party, endorsed De Leon over Feinstein. You and I predicted that that was going to happen, and it happened. But is that enough to defeat Dianne Feinstein?
You know, I am really not sure if that's enough, because you have the establishment Democrats still pushing against the change that clearly the voters in California want, the voters in the California Democratic Party want, and now we see the executive committee of the Democratic Party wants. But the question in my mind is, are the executive committee members of the Democratic Party in California behind De Leon enough that they're going to put all of their campaign funds behind him in the upcoming primary? I don't think so. And that is, I think, is going to be a problem. So I think this vote to endorse De Leon was more of an attempt to light a fire under Feinstein to get her act together, to come out and be more quote unquote progressive as a center left party is ever going to be. Because I really don't think those executive committee members who are not a part of the wave of new members who were voted in from the Sanders revolution, if you want to call it, I think that they're really just wanting to shift the party just a little tad bit more left to appease the progressives. But I don't think they are really behind the kind of change that a De Leon win would really signal. I don't think they're ready for that yet.
That really is the issue, I think. That's what it comes down to. And so far, nobody's really talking about it. But Dianne Feinstein, whether she would admit it or not, is one of the more conservative members of the Senate among the Democrats. And she is far more conservative than California. She's far more conservative, certainly, than California Democrats. And while people like her and respect her because she was a longtime mayor of San Francisco, she supported gay rights when it was unpopular to support gay rights, and she's been a senator for many, many years, She's just too conservative. And De Leon has been running on that idea that she's too conservative. Now, De Leon has his own experience. He was the president of the Senate, which is a very big deal in California. And he believes that he better represents Democrats in California. The Republicans have no chance to win the seat because there's no Republican on the ballot. But 46% to 12% is a lot of space to make up for De Leon if he has a chance to actually win this thing. Now, I don't know what their fundraising is like. I know that over the years, Feinstein has had millions and millions of dollars to spend on advertising. And I know De Leon was struggling with his fundraising several months ago, 6 months ago. But I would have to think that as we get closer and closer to November, he would be able to close that gap, because there's got to be a lot of outside money pouring into California right now.
I think with this endorsement, I think that might help. That might help a bit. But I think there's something else that people are kind of not paying close attention to. There were a lot of no confidence votes or abstentions that contributed to De Leon's win. And that was actually a strategy that was employed by Feinstein, because it's all done kind of under this guise of uniting the party. But what Feinstein and the establishment Democrats are doing, they're not really trying to unite the party around a progressive message that will appeal to the people. They're just trying to unite the party around anybody who's not an establishment Democrat.
Yeah.
So it's a very strange, California just becomes a curiouser and curiouser race. I mean, because the news about the endorsement came out Saturday after we did the last segment. So when I read the news on Saturday morning, I was like, oh my God, that happened.
And just, you know, California has a very unique voting system that a lot of people, I think, including myself, think is kind of silly. I mean, so it's the top two system. So Kevin De Leon, Dianne Feinstein, both Democrats, but they're also the only choices that are going to be on the ballot in November where most people vote, right? Because they have this primary system where the top two vote getters, in this case, Feinstein and De Leon. De Leon got 12% of the vote. Feinstein got 44% of the vote. But voters aren't going to be able to choose from, well, of course, a Republican, but also in California, there's the Peace and Freedom Party, the Libertarian Party, the Green Party. So it seems like it's something that's really like limiting choice.
Yeah, it absolutely is. But back to John's point, Feinstein has the name recognition and the money. You know, De Leon has this endorsement that unless there's a serious money infusion of cash into his campaign by the Democratic Party, not just by outside forces, I think that's going to happen. But unless it's done by the California Democratic Party, I still think he has kind of an uphill climb to beating Feinstein in November. I think he's going to come close, but I don't know if he's going to be able to do it.
You know, and I wonder, too, if even if he loses, he'll be successful in pushing her to the left. She's very independent. She's very hawkish on foreign policy, on military policy, on intelligence. But I wonder if this is enough to scare her and move her to the left.
I actually think that's what the executive committee of the California Democratic Party is hoping this does. But I think it's a very risky strategy for someone who is the age that she is. Now, I know that's like very risky territory to talk about, but I think that's a really valid factor.
Well, it is, because if she wins re-election at the end of this next term, she would be 90 years old.
Exactly. So what if she wins this election now, what incentive does she really have to change her views all that drastically to the left? She really doesn't.
Yeah, I agree. Well, let's move on to New Jersey. Yeah, I've been watching this Senate race in New Jersey with great interest because the incumbent, Bob Menendez, he's the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and until about a year ago, very, very popular in New Jersey, but he just has this kind of stink of corruption is what it is. Now, he was arrested and indicted and arraigned on corruption charges. He went to trial and the result was a hung jury. And the federal prosecution decided not to try him again. So he got off. But there's this, like I say, this smell of something that's rotten. And so even though New Jersey is a Democratic state and he's won with huge majorities in the past, this is a close Senate race now.
Yeah, because that corruption trial is sticking to him. That stink is sticking to him. And his challenger in the GOP, Hugin, who is a former pharmaceutical executive who has funded his own campaign to the tune of $15 million, all his own money, has really played up that corruption trial. And that's chipped away at Menendez's comfortable lead in what should be a really easy win, like you said, in a very blue state, in a state that Trump lost by double digits. Trump is not popular in New Jersey. And now Menendez is actually doing something that you don't see a lot of Democrats do. He's hitting back against Hugin with bringing up some old college issues that Hugin had when he was a student at Princeton, where there were questions about Hugin's comments on gay people being admitted into a very exclusive club called the Tiger Inn, I think, at Princeton, and some comments Hugin made about women being admitted into the club. So Menendez is fighting back, but that lead that Menendez has is down to single digits now.
Yeah, down to single digits, which is it's got to be frightening for the Democratic Party because they're so focused on these other Senate races that we've been talking about for the last 6 months. West Virginia and Indiana, Montana, Arizona, et cetera, et cetera. Now they're going to have to worry about New Jersey and they're going to have to spend money in New Jersey. So let's move on then to Alabama. This is an Alabama House race that a lot of people were watching. It pitted Martha Roby against it was actually pretty funny. Martha Roby is the incumbent, and she harshly criticized Donald Trump during the Republican primaries. Well, she came around to support Trump, and Trump actually endorsed her. But then another person ran against her as being more pro-Trump than the candidate that Trump endorsed. Well, Martha Roby won this race. What does that say for the general election?
In Alabama, it's Trump country. It just really is.
It sure is.
And I actually felt bad for Martha Roby because I think we talked about this race before, and her comments in particular, and how and another Republican woman who stood up against Trump and his sexist comments, and how they're being punished by the Republican voters for having an actual conscience, which tells you a lot about the kinds of people who are voting for Donald Trump. But this race also tells me a lot about not just Republican men who are Trump supporters, because that's easy, right? But it also tells me a lot about Republican women. And it exposes the role of fundamental conservative Christianity in states like Alabama, in the Bible Belt states that are very conservative, and they're also very religious. And you have to understand the kind of culture that exists in these churches that are fundamentalist. They're kind of literalist in the way they interpret the Bible. They're very traditional when it comes to gender roles. And women agree with these kinds of structures and places and roles for women in society. So, you know, while female GOP candidates are having a hard time balancing whatever morals or morality they have against Trump's clear and blatant sexism, they also have to fight against the conditioning that they know their voters are getting in their churches. And these are the people they have been grooming to be the Republican base for 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
It is a really, really interesting. And again, I feel really bad for women, you know, Republican candidates who are women like Roby, who had the bravery to stand up against what Trump said. But at the end of the day, they're just going to fall in line to win races.
And that's what happens. That happens every 2 years, and we're seeing it happen again. But before we go on to a couple of issues that I had on my list, I want to close with one that you put on yours. And that was the Democrats in the House have come up with a midterm slogan, which I hate. Go ahead and tell us what that is.
Every time I think about it, it's like the laziest political thinking that you could pop. It's to me even lazier than Hillary Clinton deciding that she didn't have to campaign in all 50 states. Mm-hmm. Because it's just for the people is the new Democratic midterm slogan. It's horrendous. It's lazy. It's not creative. It doesn't speak to really anything. It doesn't address any of the pain points that voters are experiencing. Not only does the slogan not address anything, it doesn't spark any imagination.
Nope, nothing.
The strategy behind the slogan also doesn't address anything that's actually at the forefront of people's problems right now. Now, the House Democrats are saying that they are going to highlight Trump's broken promises in regard to infrastructure spending, prescription drug costs and healthcare, and government corruption. It's not that those are not issues that are important. It's just that those are not the issues that the Trump campaign or that the Trump administration now have been touting in their pro-Trump marketing blitzkrieg. So Trump and his administration has been making a big deal about the jobs reports, the low unemployment, and you know, unemployment is lower than it's been in 30 years and blah, blah, blah. But there's a lot of misinformation and blatant lying behind those numbers. And it is unconscionable to me that the Democratic Party is not addressing those issues.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't. It's like they are basically, to me, just throwing the towel in.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like to me.
When I first heard this slogan, it immediately hits you as a terrible slogan. But then you kind of have to step back for a second and think about, okay, well, what actually makes this a bad slogan, or what makes a slogan good or bad? And you know, I was thinking of some other slogans that are popular either in present day or historical politics that were good. And I mean, one is Jeremy Corbyn's for the many, not the few, right? Like that was an extremely
That's creative.
Extremely effective slogan because it points out that there's like a conflict in society and we're with one side over the other, like you stand for something. Or there is the slogan of the Poor People's Campaign that Martin Luther King worked on at the end of his life, which was join jobs or income now. Like that's a specific and transformational thing for people's lives. If there is a guarantee of jobs or income. But for the people has like nothing like that.
No, it doesn't mean anything. Hey, let me go to a couple of, let's start off with kind of a funny one. There was a piece in the Washington Post this week talking about a Republican candidate for Senate in Wisconsin. He's a conservative Republican, a pro-Trump Republican, and his mom and dad, Michael and Donna Nicholson, made headlines for donating $2,700 each to their son's opponent.
Oh.
Yes. He wrote an op-ed about it. in which he called it an intentional personal blow.
Oh, my God.
And he said that as a child, they forced him to be a Democrat.
Oh, my goodness.
He was makes it even worse. He even became the national president of the College Democrats of America when he was a senior in college. And then he became a Trump Republican. So he's facing a state senator named Leah Vukmir in the Republican primary, which is going to take place on August 14th. But he and his parents now are not speaking to each other at all. And I just wanted to use that as an example of what has happened to politics in our country since Donald Trump was elected president.
It's bad. I mean, there's one thing when you go to Thanksgiving dinner and you make a vow that, look, I'm not going to talk about politics over dinner because I don't want to get into another argument with Cousin Frank. It's another thing entirely when politics causes an open feud to break out between parents and child, and it's aired out in the newspaper op-ed by the candidate.
Crazy. It's crazy. Well, I wanted to take a quick look too at the Tennessee Senate race that we've talked about a lot. This is Phil Bredesen. He said something very interesting this week. He told the Washington Post that if he's elected to the Senate, and it looks like he will be elected to the Senate, that he doesn't think he's going to vote for Chuck Schumer as majority leader. Now, we're seeing this happen in the House where you have more and more freshman Democrats or Democrats who are running for their first term, and they're announcing that they're not going to vote for Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi is an easy whipping boy for the Republican Party, and indeed the Republicans brag that they raise more money when they criticize Nancy Pelosi than when they do anything else. Well, Bredesen is pointing the finger now at Chuck Schumer in the Senate and saying the same thing, that Schumer's just too far to the left for a Southern Democrat to support. And so he falls into line then with Representative Kyrsten Sinema, we talked about last week, who's running for Senate from Arizona. She's the Democratic representative running in that seat or in that race. And she has already said that she will not vote for Chuck Schumer if she wins. So that's Arizona. It's Tennessee. I have to think it's going to be Alabama as well. And I wonder if this is the beginning of something or if this is just kind of a meaningless protest vote.
You know, I don't see any crosshairs on Chuck Schumer's seat right now. So I think this is just one of those meaningless campaign kind of statements that candidates in peculiar districts have to make to ensure their constituents that, you know, I'm not going to go along with those crazy people in Washington who don't understand what our values are here, right? You know, Republicans have done that all the time, and people don't realize that for Democrats who represent Southern states, they have to do that a little bit too. Even in the Democratic Party, in some places in this country, Washington Democrats are just too far left for some people in some places in this country. So I don't put a whole lot of stock into that. I think Chuck Schumer's seat is safe, but I also don't think that's necessarily a good thing either. I think he should go right along with Pelosi. So
yeah, I think so too. Politico this week, Politico magazine, had a very long analytic article entitled, "Is This the Year Arizona Finally Turns Blue?" They make quite a strong case, not just because the Democrats seem to have better candidates running for statewide offices in Arizona than the Republicans do, but because of demographic changes. Everybody knows that not just Arizona, but other states as well, North Carolina, Texas, New Mexico, California, they're turning more and more Hispanic. And Politico is arguing, this is written by Ethan Epstein, who is their top political correspondent. He's saying that Arizona is so definitively turning blue that this might be what finally turns the entire Southwest United States blue. Now, if that happens, and Texas is next, and pundits will tell you that in the next 30 years, Texas will turn blue, or at least purple. If that happens, the Republican Party may never win a national election again. The numbers just won't be there for them.
Yes. And I think that along with the kind of identity crisis that working class white voters are having in this country for a lot of reasons, that was one of the reasons that Trump was elected, the kinds of candidates that the Republican Party are having run now in a lot of these races is also indicative of the fact that they know this is coming. They know this demographic change is happening, and they're trying to hedge their bets against it, but I really don't think it's going to work. I mean, Joe Scarborough said a very interesting thing on his show the other day, where he said, because of, and this is for a different reason, but I think more moderate Republicans are coming out and just admitting that the party is done. The Republican Party, as we know it today, is done. It's imploding under its own weight. It is not going to be able to survive the Trump era.
Yeah.
I don't think. And it's not going to be able to survive the Trump era plus these demographic shifts that we're seeing. It's like Texas and Arizona.
Joe Scarborough compared it to the Whig Party of the 1850s, that it's just going to go away. We're out of time, unfortunately. Jackie, we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Jacqueline Lukman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their interesting live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.